the Polaroid snap, a desperate need for that feather in the cap. You thought your childhood was beautiful. You felt loved. You had fun. You don't know what all the fuss is about. But I'm telling you, man, that when I was someone that drank alcohol, I was a Brussels sprout. Kids, such beautiful things. Kirk Douglas dimples and chins, sweet, sweet eyes, a smell of baby breath, and then I come along with the stench of death. I hoist him onto my shoulders, swerving this way and that like a giraffe trying to become the zoo acrobat. I could have done so much more. I could have done so much more, and that's why I want to create this movement of a million people. I want our children to see that it's cool as fuck to be someone that doesn't drink alcohol. But first, we need to wake the fuck up and take a look at the devastation that we are wreaking in this world. Every time we hold a bottle of wine or a can of lager in our hand, we're a walking, talking billboard for the alcohol industry. Our children become us. The imagery, the immorality, the constant psychological battery. And that is why today's podcast is so crucial. A child telling her mother how her drinking drove their relationship to a dead end and how the transformation to someone that doesn't drink alcohol means she's now her best friend. Stella, Georgie, thanks for your honesty, courage and bravery.
Okay, welcome to the Alcohol Addiction Podcast. How's life?
Yes, Lee, fine. You buzzed a bit there.
I buzzed a bit. Where are you in the world? Tell people where you are.
You tell me. Yeah, go on. We're in East Anglia, in Suffolk, on the coast, near Southwold-ish. It's very nice.
And what's it like down that part of the world, Georgie?
Quiet. Pretty boring.
Well, I live in Ogmore Valley, and it's very quiet and very boring. And it's nice if I want to go out for a walk, but it's not exactly floating my boat. Is it somewhere you want to live for the rest of your life, or you've got plans to get away from the place?
No, I'll definitely begin back up north, probably.
Back up north. Back up north.
Yeah.
Over the other side of the wall. All right, I'm going to start with an icebreaker. So I'm going to ask Stella a question first, a random one, and then I'll ask you one, okay? If you don't want to answer it, just say pass and I'll get another one. Got all these questions in my hand.
Oh, right, you ready, wonderful.
You ready, Stella?
Yes.
I have to think about this. What's the most surprising conversation that you've had recently?
The most surprising conversation I've had recently. Oh, God, I've had so many. The most surprising conversation was when I had some Reiki on Monday, and I had this conversation with Judith. And I didn't know that Reiki is a kind of a treatment that you can have three times only, and you plug into it where you were left off for the first one. It just amazed me. That were really interesting Monday. I've never had Reiki done before except once, and that's my second time. So the conversation we had between each other, it's a bit woo-woo. Our George is not woo-woo. I'm woo-woo.
Hippie rubbish.
Hippie rubbish, she calls it. But yeah, that was the most interesting conversation I had with Judith about my Reiki and how I was absorbing things.
Okay, cool. Okay, Georgie, I'm not going to ask you that one. Can you describe your own taste when it comes to interiors and design?
Oh, yeah, probably. A little bit retro / slightly modern. I'm not so bothered about the expensive things in life. I'd rather just be comfortable. You know, if it come from a charity shop for 50p or it came from a shop for 100, it wouldn't make a difference to me as long as it was nice and it fitted in well with my atmosphere and keeping me calm and chill in my home. I guess.
So, yeah. Great, thank you. There you are. Good icebreaker. How old are you, George, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 25.
25, and how old are you, Stella?
Lee, you should never ask a woman her age.
Okay, let's say...
I'm 54.
54. Obviously, there's not a question that I will not ask. Well, other than that one I just pulled out for Georgie, which I decided not to ask. Okay, so Stella, when... Think back to the beginnings of your first earliest memories around alcohol. What were your first earliest memories around alcohol, and how did alcohol you know, what was the, like, the journey, if you like, the psychological journey from the point where you're first kind of thinking about it to the point where you start drinking it? Tell me about that a little bit.
I'd have probably been about six, and I remember my snowballs at Christmas. I loved them. But I didn't just have one, no, I'd sneak loads. Once I'd fathomed out how to make them, I would sneak and make them.
How do you make a snowball?
Lemonade and avocado.
Ah, right.
Stick a cherry on it, but I don't like those cherries. But if I was making one for somebody, I would stick one in. I was kind of like my mum and dad's host a bit when we lived in Belfast, because I used to wake up when they had parties in the flat because no one went out because of the troubles. So, but we always had seemed to have the parties at our house. Anyway, I didn't mind, but I would be like the host. You know, I'd get the beers and then I'd get the sweets or the sausage rolls and things like that. And then it jumped right from till we went to live in Yorkshire when I was about 13. And I can remember being, oh, I was so sick on Pernod and blackcurrant. Oh. And I never drank it, and I've never drank it since. Rum was another one, and red wine. Oh, but then I just couldn't have a glass then either. I had to finish the whole 3 litre bottle or whatever it was. And my friends were drinking White Lightning. That were disgusting. So yeah, 13 really.
When you
Go on, sorry.
When you were younger with your snowballs, what I mean, that reminds me actually of like eggnog at Christmas and Bailey's. It was almost like Bailey's is okay for the kids because it tastes like chocolate. What was the other one? Baby Sham. Were your parents okay with it around then? Were they like, oh, that's sweet. Little Stella's got a snowball.
Yeah.
It was the same for me.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same. Yeah. Oh, they were, yeah. They made it for me, didn't they? And then I'd make my own once I'd fathomed out how to do it. Didn't take me long to learn it.
When you said that you couldn't stop at one, even at six and at 13, is that because you really, really loved it? Or was it more a case of, wow, this makes me feel so grown up and I want to continue feeling grown up? Or were you trying to use it as a medicine to deal with a particular issue or whatever? What was the feeling and thoughts around that?
I think when I was little, I liked the taste of it. I still to this day could eat a Farley's Rust, you know, with water. So no, I liked the taste of the snowball. But then when I got older and I was with Mandy and all the girls and I was trying, yeah, I was just trying to fit in because I didn't want to be Tret in Yorkshire like I got Tret in London. When we got to London, it was horrific for the 18 months we lived there and at school. But I did drink. But I did. I only drank when they had a party. I remember having a drink at the party, but then I remembered stopping because I didn't feel safe around my mum because my mum's not a drinker and my mum was drinking that night. I can remember that now. And I pulled back and thought, whoa, you know, my mum's not looking good and this isn't going to end well. And actually it didn't end well. And my mum was upset. And the reason being was because she couldn't live where she wanted to live in London because they wouldn't have us living there. So once my mum had made a mind up and we all moved to Yorkshire, that's when I started to think, right, well, I'm not going to go down that same road I went down in London, living there and going to school there. I'm going to fit in now. So what everybody else did, I did the same, but I had to like just take it to that little bit further.
Did you take it that little bit further because you wanted to like be a leader instead of a follower, or you just really, really needed to fit in?
No, I think I just really needed to fit in because by this time I was getting into high school. So, you know, it didn't matter that I had my Irish accent. I mean, it's gone now, but it didn't matter there. It mattered in London. But I think it was just to fit in with everybody because then I was the only one in that area, going to the Catholic school, bar Andrea, of course. You remember Andrea? Me and Andrea, two girls, we went to the Catholic school. Everybody else went to the, you know, the Church of England school and Holy Trinity. So when I got there, it started again. You know, my next 5 years was like all brand new again, all these brand new people, you know. I suppose it's kind of like, what's the word? Like finding your place. But I know, looking back, I was probably a person who never really wanted a place. Maybe I thought I did, and that's why I never found a place, because I just, it was just my aura. I didn't want to be in a place. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That's probably why it never happened. I was never in a group of like loads of people. I've always just had like one friend to call on, and then another one friend to call on. I never kind of like got in this group fixing. Yeah, it never kind of accepted me somehow. Yeah, then I would back off, and then I'd try again, and then I'd back off. And yeah, I never sort of fitted in on the group.
Can you remember the time when you realised it, you know, your drinking had escalated to what we would call like a problem? Like you started to think to yourself, hang on a minute, this isn't right, because you know the score, Stella. You can go many, many years just thinking that drinking alcohol is normal and it's brilliant and it's great. You never, ever think it. Even the worst hangovers in the world, you're not thinking this is a problem. You just think a hangover comes with drinking. It's just normal. When was the point when you said, oh, hang on a minute, this doesn't feel right?
I suppose when I moved to Suffolk. And then my really first one was just rowing all the time with Alan over stupid stuff. And then I stopped drinking for 7 years and drank on holiday. And the main reason why I did that was because I didn't trust any parent around this area to pick up or drop off Layla and Georgie if they were going to be late at night. Georgie weren't so much as a problem as Layla. I never once had to go and pick Georgie up in Yarmouth or anywhere like that. But I wanted to be free if needs be. But with Layla, I had to pick her up at like 4:30 in the morning in Norwich. And the reason why I did it is because, I didn't trust anybody else. You know, all the mums were all right to do it in the beginning, dropping them off. But nobody really wanted to ever pick up. But I still drank when we went on holiday. And then when we got on holidays and I had a drink, it was always the same again. We'd start bickering and we'd argue, and I was like, bloody shit. And it was always, I always took the blame because I always felt that I was the one that did it. I don't know, but I just did, I suppose. I just did, didn't I? I used to just say, oh, well, here we go again, you know. Here we go again. And then it just went on a loop. And then when the girls didn't need me anymore and I was still doing it, and I can remember distinctly the day that I drank again at home in this house was when Layla met her new partner and his parents came to visit. And I was on my water and I was quite happy just pottering around, and Layla kept saying, would you like a second one? Would you like, no, no, I'm all right just now. And then I suppose if I'd have really thought, and what I know now, joining your group and stuff, and I thought, oh, I'll be all right, I'll just have one Prosecco. And that was it, boom. Back where I started like 8 years ago, and that was it. And then the rest is history. Then it got, you just get tolerant then, don't you? You really do. I mean, I didn't think I'd be a person who could polish off 3 bottles of Prosecco and then pass out in my chair. What went on in between the 1.5 to the 1.5 bottles in between, I can't remember. Mm. She's laughing and I cannot remember a thing. I could have been a mass murderer, Lee. I could have been one of your, oh, I don't know. I can't remember, so.
I mean, the scary things about getting into those states, especially being female, I think, is you've got, on the one hand, you've got, I can't remember anything and I could have done this or that I can't remember. But there's also the, anybody could have done this or that to me as well, you know. And it's the one thing that I constantly always had in my mind. Like I would, I remember when I stopped drinking, I would never go out with my ex-wife. And what I would do is I would drive her to the pub and then I would say to her, now you ring me when you're coming home and I will pick you up. Because like she could have walked home, it would have taken her 30 minutes. But you don't want someone drunk walking home in the middle of night at 1:00 in the morning in that state. And I would drive down to pick her up and it would be like a scene out of The Walking Dead or a classic George Romero zombie movie where you would have women with handbags and high heels in their hand, like literally falling into the road with cars beeping. And like anything could happen, like that. We do live in a place where, you know, men can be like, you know, most terrible things on the planet, you know, and it always worries me, that kind of stuff. So Yeah, I totally hear you. Especially now I've got a daughter. I think about these things and worry about these even more. Okay, we're just going to switch over to Georgie a little bit. Georgie, what were your first memories of alcohol when that you can remember? And again, in the same way that I asked your mum, how did that develop into where you stood when you was a kid stroke teenager around your thoughts around drinking?
Obviously, mine probably started from being at home. I mean, I think my first proper memory of alcohol is a day that my auntie and my uncles were down, actually, and they had mum and dad were drinking with them, and we were all on the internet having a bit of a laugh with my cousins, and then things got a little bit out of hand, and I think that was kind of the first thing for me and my sister as a pair to try and, you know, defend our parents as such, in a way that we saw the first effects of alcohol and how it would affect them, as you know, and us going forward. And then I think then as we started to grow up, we then realised that it was a big problem for our life, where we would go to a party and would be fearful of what was going to happen next and where we would possibly go. And then I think things got a lot easier and better for me and my sister as mum then decided that she'd stop drinking for a little while, and that went on for about 4, 5, 6 years maybe. And things got better. We would go to parties where with family that we wouldn't then be worried about, and mum got a little bit more defensive about herself and said, right, now I'm not going to go. So then we stayed at home rather than having to be made to go to these parties, whereas before it was we went because they went where the alcohol went. And then obviously as we grew up, I experienced it probably for my first time at home with a bunch of friends in the garden, which was better than obviously going out and getting it off the willy-nilly streets of people. But I then started to hang around with people that were a lot older than me. So we would then hang around down the park and we'd have a few drinks on a Saturday night. And we quite enjoyed that. But then it got to the point where you hit 18 years old and I got a bit bored of it. So I think that must have been about 14, 15. And we'd buy a bottle of 3 litre wine from a co-op for about £5. And now it doesn't really interest me. You know, I work with it on a day-to-day basis. I see the first-hand effects. You were just saying about, you know, how mum would go and pick up Layla from clubbing and how you'd be worried about your daughter walking home. I was driving home from work in December. I think it was one of our very last Christmas party nights. And we watched a load of people getting drunk, you know, as you do, and they're thrown up in the corridor and you're having to clean that up as a bar manager. And then I'm driving home with one of my colleagues and there's a young girl walking alone on the street, hysterically, frantically waving her arms, screaming and crying, and I had to put her in the car. And I mean, she could have done anything to me, but you can't, you know, as a human being, really, you don't want to leave that person because you think, well, anything could happen to her. I mean, she was in such that state of mind where anybody could have had her and grabbed her. So, you know, I think mine was when a lot of my friends as well were always, they never really... I think the last straw is when they leave you. And I think if you go out together, you stay together, you don't leave each other. So that was, you know, that's the last straw for me. If people can't look after you, then I don't think you're in the right place to be drinking with those people. So now I tend to, if I have a drink, it's, you know, in the comfort of my own home and I'll have maybe 2 beers and go to bed. But that's about it. I don't, you know, we're not excess drinkers. I think we've seen the first hand of that. We don't want to.
I did a podcast yesterday where I was dealing with the fact that people worry about what they're going to say to their friends if they go out and they don't want to drink, you know. And I gave the advice, well, what you should do is go out and really enjoy the anticipatory build up to the night, and like from 6 till 9, really enjoy the banter and all the joking. But at 9 o'clock, when everyone starts to get drunk, just leave and don't worry about leaving because nobody will know you've gone. Nobody will give a shit that you've gone. No one will give a fuck. No one will care about you because everyone is just so completely selfish when they've had a drink. And that flows right into what you said, which is terrifying as well, is that particularly like when you're away on like a girl's weekend out, so like you're in Amsterdam or you're in Lisbon or you're in London or something for the weekend and you turn around and everybody's gone or you're on your own because alcohol, you know, you lose control, you lose memory, you lose... your inhibitions kind of just melt away, and all of a sudden the need and the security of your mates, they're not there, and you look around and you're on your own. So I think what you make there is like a super important point. I want to go back to your early thought about alcohol, just so I can get clear. Were you saying, Georgie, that in the beginning when you started to recognize that your aunties and your uncles and your mum and dad were drinking alcohol, that your experiences were negative, like the way that the adults were behaving made you afraid, or you didn't like that experience? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not painting my parents as bad people, because they're not. My mum and dad are fantastic, and they will always, you know, they've always stood by me and my sister, and I know for a fact that even then they would have always done anything to help us, and they would always look after us. Even my aunties and my uncles, you know, they're there to look after me, and they have done. But I think when there was alcohol involved, me and my sister kind of made this pact that we would always stand by each other, and we become more of a tighter unit because we were scared. You know, there's a time where I remember we went to a family do and a family party, and me and my sister were left on the side of the road, and we didn't know what to do while mum and dad were arguing. You know, but we said to each other, you know, we know where we've come from, we know where we need to go, and if that means that we have to walk back together, then we walk hand in hand. We don't talk to anybody, we don't answer to anybody, and if somebody stops, then we run. But we run together, you know. So we made like this little pact in our bedroom one day that we would always be there to protect each other and look after each other. Because I think it did get scary at times. It was worrying, especially when you're walking home from town, and I mean town's about a 30-minute walk from us. So when you're walking home, and instead of your parents walking you home hand in hand, you're walking your parents home at the age of 10, it becomes a little bit more of a negative feeling in life, you know. And at 10 years old, you don't really expect to be looking after your parents. They should be looking after you. You know, and for my sister, obviously, it may have been a little bit harder. You know, she spoke to me in the last few weeks and told me how she felt, so that I could express a little bit for her. And with her being older, you know, it was harder for her because she felt responsible for me, and then she felt more responsible for mum and dad. So, you know, I think in that aspect, it was fearful and it was scary. You know, and then when mum then decided not to drink, things got a lot better. But it would never be great because dad never stopped. So we were always going to always go back into the same cycle, especially when, you know, you've got a family of four that's working as a unit of three or a unit of two in an area that nobody really wants to be in but one. If that makes sense.
Did you ever sit down with your mum or your dad and express how you feel and ask them to stop?
See, that's a very good question, actually, because we have tried, you know. Layla's tried lots of different things. I tended to stay out of it as such because I was struggling with my own life and working out how I was going to tell the world how I am and my sexual orientation and who I am and what I want to do with my life and who I want to be. I was struggling with that. I didn't really feel the need to be mothering my parents because I shouldn't be doing that, whereas my sister took more of that role. You know, she was more of the mother figure and trying to work out how to stop them from drinking. I felt like it was a much easier solution to just go out the door, lock the door behind me, and take my dog with me, and me and my dog would go for miles and we'd play with friends, and I'd be out from 9 a.m. until about 2 a.m. in the morning, and then I'd come home, I'd sleep, and I'd go straight back out again, you know. But the times that I were there, there'd be times where you'd sit and we'd look at them and tell them to stop, because enough was enough, and they're damaging themselves, let alone us. But there's only so much you can say. It's like talking to a brick wall, isn't it, really?
Yeah, basically. And then just on that, Stella, do you remember conversations where Layla would talk to you and about your drinking and maybe ask you to stop? Do you remember those conversations?
Some of them. Sometimes I'd just say, perhaps you should look at your dad sometimes. Don't, you know, keep shouting at me. Nah, 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 nah. You know, I always had a backup plan, more or less. And I always kind of like said, I'm not doing it. I don't drink as much and I don't do it as much as that, but you're always talking to me. You're always asking me to do it. I can't bloody make your dad do something, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, we used to clash a lot. Yeah. And then, and of course, we didn't clash the times that we did. But then we just used to have to ignore Alan sitting in the chair and doing what he'd done. So we just...
I think where Mum's coming from there is like, when we did try to express... it wasn't particularly aimed just at Mum. It was aimed at them both, where Layla would say, you know, look what you're doing to each other, guys. Look what, you know, you're doing to yourselves as in people. I think my dad is a very extremely laid back person. He takes everything on the chin and he just gets on with life and, he doesn't face with things head on. Whereas Mum's personality is very, if you say something, it's an attack form and she's got to be defensive, especially when... It was when alcohol was involved, it was more of we're aiming it directly at her, and it wasn't that in the slightest, you know. We were just trying to get across the fact that they are hurting each other as a couple, and us genuinely as a family, you know. So we wanted it to be peaceful and happy, but Mum took that so on board. I think she understood more than anything, maybe. She realised. And that's why she was defensive, because she didn't really maybe see a way out of it. But we weren't just aiming it directly there.
You know? I mean, what comes up for me when you're both sharing this stuff, and thank you, because I know it's not easy. Whenever I need to affect a change within my family dynamic, whether it's alcohol or generally it's more around smoking, both my parents smoke a lot, I'm never going to go to my dad. Like I'm always going to go to my mum, because if I go to my mum, because she carried me in her belly, maybe has something to do with it. Maybe because she's female and she has that female energy, she is more likely to listen to me and she is more likely to change than my dad. My dad, with his testosterone and his very old school, I'm the leader of this family and I cannot think of anything more inflammatory than a child trying to tell an adult what to do, by the way. My dad is never going to listen to me. To this day now, he will never listen to me. But if I can get my mum to listen to me and my mum to change, so for example, if my mum stopped smoking, then maybe my dad could stop smoking and maybe I could talk to him about it. But there's no way if I went to my dad that he would change. And if I went to them both together, then they would both just gang up together and just say, what the fuck do you know? You're just a kid, blah, 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 blah. It's nothing to do with you. And what you're talking about here is actually making me think that maybe we at the Truth About Alcohol could do some more work around providing an outlet or a way for children to go to talk and express about how they're feeling, because a lot of the times their parents are just going to be suffering from the death effect, Stella, right?
Massively. It is a death effect. You do, Lee, you stick up for it. You stick up for it no end. See, this is the thing where it needs to come out that it's alcohol's on a different platform than other drugs. And it shouldn't be. It should be on the same platform as another drug. And they should be taught that. But they're not. They're taught that alcohol is acceptable and it's okay. You're either an alcohol that drinks and you're an alcoholic, or you're an alcohol that drinks and you're a happy one, or you're an alcohol that drinks and you argue all the time. Well, I mean, alcohol doesn't do that, does it? I mean, alcohol does all three. You know, it doesn't just pick on one and you take it in your body and, oh, I'm a happy soul, me, when I drink. Oh, I never have a problem with it. But you must have had a problem with it. And I think I'm not apologising anymore for not drinking. You know, if I went round someone's house and this, you know, I'm dying to say this at a party, and I say, oh, no, thank you, but I wouldn't mind one of those lovely, oh, you don't drink. No, I don't drink, actually. Oh, but I tell you what, if you've got any heroin or a bit of cocaine, I'll have a bit of that. Oh, I'd love to say it, Lee.
Yeah.
I'd love to say it. Have you got any of that in the fridge? Because it's the same thing. But people don't realise it's the same thing. And it makes you happy, but they defend it. That's the thing. And I was the one, I defended it too. you know, I defended it, and you don't know why you're defending it. And of course you're defending it because you're addicted to the bloody stuff, you know, and you associate it with nostalgic things like a Sunday afternoon and a Saturday afternoon when you finish work. And if it's a bank holiday and it's Sunday, you know, you got to drink all day Monday because it's a bank holiday. Yeah,
that's funny.
Oh, come on, it's bank holiday. Come on, I mean, let's get through a crater broadside because it's bank holiday Monday. Then you get Easter. It's supposed to be a time of God. No, is it heck? It's a time for you to be down the pub for 48 hours for the whole 72 hours you're off work. And sleep for three and get up and do it all over again.
Everyone just finds an excuse.
Of course. Oh, it's 11:30. I can't have one at 11:30. Well, who cares? It's 5:00 somewhere. And somebody will always come up with that. And then you get another pint and you start all over again. So, yeah, I was defending it. But going back and Georgie giggling about the non-smoking in your mum and dad. You see, the strange thing is, right, everything that I have done, Alan has followed me eventually, which is really odd. And Georgie can answer now because she's sitting here. But when I decided to stop drinking, last May, I stopped. October 2017. And Alan stopped in the May, and I would have never believed it. If I would have literally had to have done whatever I said I was going to do if he wasn't going to, like, eat my hat, I had to have vet it. Anyway, he hasn't, and he hasn't spoken about it, but there's only one person in his whole family that's asked Alan why. And it was you, weren't it?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, why did you stop drinking, Dad?
We were home alone and we were in the garden. And I noticed and I thought, oh, I'll just bring it up. Because, you know, people don't talk about something that they're either, I don't know, still trying to overcome themselves or, you know, that they're struggling with it slightly. And Mum had told us, he didn't even say a word. So I thought, oh, I'll just ask him in the garden one day. And sat down with the dog and I said, you stopped drinking. He didn't really say much. I said, you heard me. What did you stop drinking? And he went, yeah. I said, what for? And he went, because I was a bit fed up, really, of sitting there on my own with a bottle of wine. And, you know, you guys would come in and you were having a bright conversation and you'd go upstairs and see your mum and bloody blah. And I'm just sat there on my own. And I said, well, it's probably best that you have stopped drinking then, isn't it? And then, you know, from that day, kind of, you know, everyone become a little bit more of a unit. For once, we had Christmas with no arguments. You know, everyone managed to sit around the table. It was lovely. Our first Christmas probably since I've been alive that nobody's actually ripped into anybody or, you know, somebody stormed off or we're arguing about a dog barking or Dad's overcooked the potatoes or something ridiculously stupid.
And broke.
Now we sit downstairs, you know, and Mum will be sat there and Dad will be sat there and we can all have a conversation rather than having a conversation with Mum or having to go upstairs because Mum doesn't want to be around the fact Dad's still drinking two bottles of wine every night. You know?
It must have been so difficult for him to even talk about it and to do something about it. I keep thinking about my dad. My dad is like super stubborn, you know, and but it goes to show that, like, so for Stella, for example, tell me if I'm wrong, you didn't preach to Alan, you didn't tell him what to do, you just went on your own road. And then actually what happened was he saw you change, you being a role model, realized that the kids were gravitating more to you. I imagine when he's had a drink and you haven't, you don't really want to be around him, you don't want to hang around him, you certainly don't want to engage in conversation with him. And all of a sudden, he's probably feeling really isolated and lonely. And,
yeah,
you know, well done to him for actually doing something about it.
Yeah, he said he said that he felt really isolated and he felt lonely. And he's been so proud on his journey as well, going forward now. He's been more expressive with the way he behaves. And, you know, he's got high blood pressure and his high blood pressure's dropped massively.
Right.
And we came round one day and he's like, oh my God, look, watch this. Put his blood pressure monitor on and things like that.
A machine.
And he said that his anxiety towards things has become better. So, you know, but that's all down to Mum. Because if my Mum not have stopped, it wouldn't have stopped. You talk about your parents with the smoking situation. My dad never really smoked. He was a social smoker, but he smoked. He just liked to hide it. He was never the sort of dad where we would be able to see him smoking, you know. And that obviously stemmed to Layla never, she frowned upon smoking, she hated it. But then, you know, I'd go off and I'd sneak the odd cigarette and stuff and become a smoker myself because of my parents, obviously, because you do, you follow suit and you think, oh, it's cool. Mum does it, dad does it, wicked, then I should do it, you know. And then when mum gave up, shortly followed by then dad, you know, believe it or not. So it is, it's like what you say in life is true, you know, if mum does something, dad follows. Yeah. So if mum moves, dad might follow.
Yeah, and similarly, that can be used for negatives. Like, I always remember my ex-wife, she didn't take drugs, she didn't smoke, she didn't drink when I met her. And then over our time, I smoked, took drugs, drank, and then before you know it, she's doing all three. They follow you. There is a likelihood that they can follow you if you do something more positive, but there's also, you know, the same thing happens if it's negative. I think another thing for listeners to like really focus on here, because there'll be a lot of parents listening to this who've got children. I think what we need to accentuate here is we won't be aware of the lack of presence that we're having as adults with our kids when we're drinking, because we'll be too wrapped up in our drinking. We will be suffering from the death effect. We will want to defend ourselves to the hilt because we won't want our children telling us adults what to do. And that is all perfectly acceptable and normal behavior. But just know this, that when you are in a room getting drunk with all your mates or whatever, you're at a party, you're not connecting with your child. You're not present with your child. And, you know, I always remember having parties around the house a lot. And the kids would be lined up on the couch with their DSs. Like there would be like five or six kids on their DSs, just playing on their DSs, not talking to each other. And then we would all be in the kitchen playing poker and drinking. And you think that that's all right. You think to yourself, yeah, well, that's the modern age. They're playing on their video games and all that kind of stuff. But actually what happens is in 10 to 15 years time or 20 years time, they will start, or they could possibly start, having real serious problems in their relationship, because they haven't developed an emotional intelligence, right? And that emotional intelligence is developed by sitting down with your child, reading them books, explaining the books, explaining about life, listening to them about their problems and their troubles. But we don't have that capacity when we're drinking. We don't have the capacity for our children. We're just like, oh, fucking leave me alone. I've got my own problems to deal with. You know, it's like, I can't do that. Like homework becomes a grind, like playing becomes a grind. I remember coming home and my kid would be like straight at me. Come on, play, come on, play, come on, play. And I would be like, hang on and let me get a beer. You know, it's like, I'll play with you in a bit. And before you know it, he's going to bed. And I'm just in front of the TV watching a football with a beer. But now it's different. Now it's like, you know, people say, how do you fill the white space? Well, when you've got kids, how you fill the white space is you spend the time with your kids. You know, that's what you do. So,
yeah, it's a white space. That's what I said to Georgie earlier before we came on the podcast. I said, I can't sit there and say anything about when I was drunk because I ain't got no right, really, because I ain't got a clue. The one person who can take over this whole podcast about that is Georgie, because obviously, up to the age of 10, 12, she was sober as a judge and saw it for herself. She saw everything for the true, how it were true. I can't say anything because it's not true. Because I don't know, do I?
No.
And I said that when I was stopped drinking ages ago, a long time ago. I said, do you know what's the best thing? This is to Layla and Georgie. I said, do you know what's the best thing of all about not drinking? That nobody, but nobody who's had one drink past their lips can say one bad word to me. That is empowering me, I said to Layla and Georgie, and I absolutely love it. And that's what made me white knuckle it for those years that I didn't. But then you see, I don't call myself a non-drinker because I drank on holiday. And we did go to Yorkshire quite a few weekends, you know, like all the bank holidays, Easter. We went on holiday like twice a year for two weeks at a time. And then I straight away, I'd be on the plane and that'd be it.
You're basically doing a 6-monthly routine. So 6 months of the year you wouldn't drink, and 6 months of the year you were drinking.
Yeah, there you are.
So you know,
yeah.
And it becomes irrelevant, then you're still a drinker, aren't you? And then that then takes on toll. You know, that when Layla's partner and their family came down, that was when it truly got on toll with everybody, I think. And, you know, I tended, by that point, I was at college somewhere else and I was, you know, living my own life, doing my own thing. So I didn't really see much of that, only what I heard from Layla. but you say about, you know, the children sitting on the DSs and stuff. We live in a society now where it's acceptable to spend 5-6 hours in the pub with your child. And even when, you know, when I was younger, you still do it now, you know, I would have sat in the pub for nearly 10-12 hours at a time. I remember we'd finish on a Saturday afternoon. By the time I was 12, I would go down to the skate park. I'd go on my BMX and then it would get to 1:30. Mum would have finished work. I knew that on my watch. And I'd be like, right, time to go to the Angel. Get to the Angel and we would be able to sit down and I knew my pizza would be ready. So I would sit down and I'd have a pizza with mum and dad. And then we would sit there and then we would go off and carry on down the skate park. With we would then end up sitting down, go back to the skate park where we would, you know, then wait for the promoted phone call of when we were going to go home. And this phone call could be an hour later. It could be 4 hours later. It could be, it's getting dark. My friends have gone home and now I have to go and get my parents to take my parents home.
Yeah.
You know, that, and that's the world that we live in. And even now, I mean, I live opposite a pub and it's a very busy pub during the summer. And there was times where I sat there in the beer garden having a few ciders after work. And I would sit there and I'd watch these families come along and all these kids were playing on a bouncy castle. And all these kids then started to get irritable. You know, it's only fun for so long, bouncing up and down, isn't it? You know, by yourself.
Get bored.
They do get bored. And then, you know, they're asking for their family to play. And it was always, yeah, in a minute, in a minute, in a minute. And then before you know it, these parents are sinking 6 or 7 pints in. They can't even bounce. They can't even walk, let alone bounce on a bouncy castle. And then their kids are getting whingy and they're just pushing them to one side, like, oh, yeah, in a minute. Oh, yeah, I'll deal with you in a minute. Here, have this piece of technology. And all of a sudden, you've got this child, like you said, that's sitting there in a row with a bunch of friends. They're not talking, they're not interacting, they have no idea what's going on around them. All they know is they're going to get shoved in the taxi in 2 hours' time and they're going to go home. And that's, I think, a lot of where alcohol stems in children's lives, especially mine as well. It's so easy just to plug a child with technology now that you disengage with taking them, if you didn't drink, to the skate park. Why didn't my parents come and watch me? You know, why didn't my parents come and watch me play football with my friends? You know, as such, my dog was kind of my parent. You know, I would take my dog to the football pitch and he would sit and lay in the corner and watch me play football. You know, and then we'd walk him home talking to him about it. Like me and my sister would be like, oh, look, we played hockey today. Or, you know, or you'd get home from school and you'd get your dog and you'd go for a walk with him. You couldn't speak to your parents because they were too busy worrying about when they were going to get their next little fix, as I should say, of when they were going to be able to grab their easiest drink. So we'd walk the dog and tell our dog about our school day. Because really, realistically, they weren't really that interested. They were there, they'd listen, but it wasn't when you can talk to somebody and they're listening, but then you talk to somebody and they're not even engaged. They're there, but they're not. And that was what it was like growing up. It was tough. It was hard.
The eyes are dead.
You know, yeah. They're there as a human figure, but they're not there in emotional states or, you know, I remember a time where we were, where were we? We're talking about mum and my BMXing. We were, you know, dad had gone to pick mum up, and this was the first time that we were actually physically allowed to stay at home on our own. For one of the very first times, you know, Layla's about 14, I'm about 13. And mum had said, yeah, right, okay, fine. For the first time, you can stay at home on your own. We thought, oh, brilliant, okay, this is great. Now, the lady over the back of the house had said, right, yeah, you know, we'll watch them. You know, dad went down to pick mum up. And we thought it was a fantastic idea that all day we'd been building this ramp for our bikes. And, you know, I had my BMX and we were like, yes, let's go. We'll test this ramp out. And over we go and I smacked my face and skidded along the floor off a curb because I came off. and I smacked my chin open. I got, and I remember sitting on the lady's counter, kitchen worktop, with a massive hole in my chin and scrapes all down my chest. And they're trying to phone my parents and find out where they were. And they were at the Angel having some drinks. And I remember sitting in the car and all I wanted was my mum. And then I was in the hospital. I had my chin all stitched up.
And but I'm like, of all the bloody days. And I was like, oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah. It was scary because, you know, and I think it was shortly after that, actually, you did give up for a while because, you know, this is nothing to do with my family, but it brings that memory back all the time for me. I've got two nieces now. Now my partner's mum, she drinks quite an excess amount, a little bit like what happened, you know, with my mum and dad. And my partner goes through quite a lot of that herself. And we were there for lunch the other day. And I mean, my nieces are very young. One's 3 months old, very cute, very tiny, and one's 18 months, very bubbly, out there doing, you know, trying to learn about the world. And she was asleep upstairs, and we were all going to go home, and my partner's mum was like, no, leave her, you know. And morally, I think we should, because she's sleeping, she's growing, you know. But then for her safety, it's best that we take her home, because had something have happened to that child that evening, there was absolutely nothing her mum, as a human, as an adult, as her caregiver at that point, could have done, because she'd been drinking all day, you know. So that's then bringing it back to how long before our memories actually begun of our parents, you know. Was there a time where we would go to bed and they were drunk, and, you know, and then there's nothing they can do for us if we needed to get to an emergency room, you know, they wouldn't be able to take us. Or if something bad happened, they wouldn't be able to do anything about it, you know. And that's where then you get this massive strain for the NHS, because people are too busy doing their own life and getting drunk. They can't control and look after their own children.
I think that was my light bulb moment, that was, Lee, because then, you see, I was only just at the bar getting a drink. So I was fine. But Alan had already had a few, so I had to drive to the Ipswich Hospital. And then I had to try and make it fun and say, look, don't, because of course, as soon as your child sees you, they start to cry, don't they, as soon as they see their mom. Poor old Georgie, I had her stood in the sink and danking her down with Dettol, and I knew we had to go to the hospital. I just knew. Alan's like, no, we don't have to take her. I said, oh, we definitely do.
See, that's the thing that right there, that I think that's the bit that hurts the most, you know. Even as two parents together, mum's like, we need to go. And then there's the other hand of a parent where maybe, I don't know whether it's because maybe he wanted to go back to the pub, or it was such a far journey to go to the hospital. Maybe he was just genuinely thinking about me and saying, no, we don't really need to go, you know, she'll be okay, blah, blah. But realistically, had he maybe have not had 3 pints, he'd have been straight in the car and would have been gone. But alcohol takes its toll, where you then have to rethink about things, and you then go, oh, do we really need to go? Do we though?
Yeah, you start questioning.
Because then, when am I going to get my next pint, you know? And I've just ordered one, and now we've got to go to the hospital because the child smashed their chin open. Brilliant. What a hindrance.
Yeah.
You know, and then as a child, you do feel like a bit of a hindrance into life.
Well, I imagine. I mean, it depends who gets to you first. I mean, I'm thinking in my head, if the mum gets to you first, it's generally kind of care and compassion. And if the dad gets to you first, it's like, what the fuck have you done, you idiot? Like, I remember just starting a poker game. We just started a poker game. We'd ordered a Chinese. I'd started drinking. You know, I'd actually been drinking all afternoon. We were getting into this poker game, and my phone went, and it was my mum, and she was crying her eyes out. And I said, what's the matter? And she said, your dad's just tried killing himself. Now, we're talking, it's probably 10 minutes away for me to get down there. And I remember, she said, he's just tried killing himself. And I said, for fuck's sake, I've just started a game, mum. And then she said, are you hearing me? He's just tried to kill himself. I said, I'll be there in a minute. And I remember coming down the house, trying to wake him up. The ambulance came.
And then the ambulance guy said, someone's going to have to come in the ambulance with him. And my mum was a mess and she'd been drinking. So I said, well, I guess it's going to have to be me. And all the way to the hospital with my dad, who had just tried to kill himself, I just kept saying to him, you fucking selfish bastard. And I had no empathy or nothing. All I was interested in was the fact that he's just ruined my night. You know, so I can imagine like parents thinking that of their children as well when they just, oh, I'm at the pub and she's just hurt her chin. I can really imagine it. The other thing that came up for me there, Georgie, which is something to think about, you said earlier on about how it seems wrong that at 10 years of age you're actually kind of put into that parent role at a very, very young age. What I found with my parents, particularly my father, and I've seen it with my father-in-law, is they learned how to parent by their parents. So they were handed down a blueprint of how to be a parent from their parents. And I think, you know, we can pretty reasonably say that if you go forward, our parenting ability, given the internet and all this kind of stuff and things we're learning, is getting better and better as we go through our generations, which means it's probably worse and worse as we go back, you know. There was a time when someone would get the belt out and start whacking people, and that was just normal parenting. And now today it's kind of like, well, hang on, I don't think you should be smacking your kid type of thing, right? And my dad now sees me parent differently than he used to. And I see that changes in him. So for example, my dad is the kind of guy who will shake, my two-year-old comes in and he will go to shake her hand. I now kiss him and hug him. So now he's got it in his head that it's acceptable to kiss and hug your children. Actually feels good. And it's acceptable to kiss and hug your grandchildren and it feels good. And you can feel him softening up. It's almost like as your parents get older, they look at the behavior of their children and it changes the way they are as grandparents. It's almost like they have a second lease of life. So if we as children, I'm putting some pressure on you now, Georgie, if we as children are now kind of like acting differently to our parents, then they will become better grandparents for our children as we move forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get exactly what you mean actually, because I've got a goddaughter that is basically, she might as well be in the family. She's just mm-hmm. our child and part of our family really. She's fantastic. She's now 8, and my parents got first introduced to her when I brought her home at 6 weeks old. I had her first of all when she was 3 weeks, and I had her for about a week and a half, and then my mum and dad came back off holiday and I had her at 6 weeks old and brought her home. And my parents are fantastic with young kids. They're brilliant. They're lovely, you know. Mm-hmm. They've always been fantastic with her, you know. They've been brilliant with her, but as you know, she's got older and older, I can see the difference in, you know, how me and my sister as children were maybe, we can see, let me step back a second. We can see how my parents would have obviously treated us as kids because, you know, they're not really her grandchild, but, you know, we can see how, you know, we were played with and how they interacted with us without the alcohol. And then it was quite an eye opener to see when I did have my goddaughter, how they behaved when they had alcohol, you know, and then you kind of sit there and you think, wow, how are we still alive?
Yeah, like coming home and throwing them on your shoulder and running around the house when you've had 15 pints of cider.
You know, there's a fire going in the corner and, you know, and it's red hot and my parents are just sitting there drinking two bottles of red wine and I've come in from seeing my friends for about half an hour at a youth club and left my goddaughter with them. I come back and she's running around naked, like wrecking the joint, and my mum's asleep in the chair, and my dad's like, oh, how funny, and I'm like, oh my God, anything could happen, you know, and you just sit there and you think, wow, how am I still alive at 25?
So how has your relationship changed with your parents now that they don't drink alcohol, Georgie?
My mum's my best friend.
Oh.
She is. Nice. Massively, huge. I mean, I think had my mum not have given up drinking in 2017, I can safely and openly say on my heart of hearts, I would not be in my mum and dad's home now. In all honesty, I wouldn't have been. The last straw for me was when they came to my work and they were arguing in my restaurant. Now, I'm a retail and bar manager and I have a very, very strict policy of drunk people. I have to uphold that very strict policy in my workplace, regardless of who you are and what you do. And I'm sat in my office one day with 150 people working underneath me for one of them to ring me and tell me that my parents were arguing in the middle of my very important restaurant that seats 150 people that have paid a good amount of money for. And my parents got for free. We just asked them to pay for the alcohol that, you know, that they drank. Their meal was completely and utterly free. Their table was free all day. And that was the last straw for me. And, you know, it that hit me hard. And I said to my partner, it doesn't matter. However long my parents are on this earth, I will always love them dearly. But if something doesn't change, I will never step foot in that house. And that was the last day. I couldn't do it anymore. Enough was enough, you know. And my sister said that that was harsh and that I'm to stand by them. And I thought, no, I'm not to stand by them. They're adults, you know, and I've always come to that conclusion. It doesn't matter how old I get now. They're adults. They're my parents. I'm not theirs. And as far as I'm concerned, if they're not going to grow up and step up and do something about it themselves, then doesn't matter what I say, doesn't matter what I do, it will never, ever, ever change unless they physically do it themselves. And so at that point forward, I would never have stepped foot back in this house until something had changed. And it took for my sister to text me in December on Christmas Day. Me and my partner were sat in our little flat. You know, we moved out and everything. I'd moved out in the August of that year. And then that happened in the October. And then I didn't speak or hear from anybody until December, I think around Christmas time. My sister texted and she said, "Mum hasn't drunk. Please come round and see us." And I said, "Right, I'll come round," and I'm coming round for an hour. And that was it. Had she have texted and said, you know, "Mum and Dad are drinking and blah, 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 come round," I'd be, no, I'm not going. Because I didn't need that in my life anymore. You know, it was affecting me mentally. It was affecting me physically. And it was also at that point, it affected my job. A job that I'd worked extremely hard for, you know, and a position that and an appearance to people that I'd tried to uphold from the minute I turned 18 right up till now, you know, and that got affected and jeopardized. And that was the biggest hole for me. Because if my parents could do that to me there, what else is going to happen in my life that I really am not going to like? And, you know, if I then had children, what would happen to them? I didn't need that embarrassment in my life. You know, I struggled with enough on my own, with my own sexual life and, you know, my orientation about people and coming out and everything like that. That was difficult enough to then be, I kind of feel like I was a bit degraded, you know, and it was disrespectful.
Well, was there also a part of this where you are going through, I know this is going to be difficult for you, Stella, but you're going through, I mean, when we talk about becoming people that don't drink alcohol, Georgie, we've actually stolen the term coming out, because people find it really difficult, shameful, guilt, whatever. They find it difficult to tell people that they don't drink alcohol anymore. They find it really, really difficult, right? So you're going through a real major time in your life where I imagine at some point were very confused about your sexuality, about why you were thinking or being attracted to certain genders and why, what was going on? Am I different to everybody else? Blah, 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 blah. And at the time you're going through this, your parents are not really there. I mean, that must have been like really difficult.
Yeah. That was really hard. I mean, we went to, this is actually probably the easiest way to explain it. We went to my sister's hen do 3 or 4 years. Wow, 2015, 14. Years, a few years ago. Now, I have a cousin, and my cousin's gay. You know, so we've spoke about a few things. I agree with some of the stuff he does, and he agrees with some of the stuff I do, and we have disagreements, blah blah blah. But my auntie was there, and my mum. So it was a prime opportunity to explain a little bit about how coming out feels, especially with parents that are there and parents that are, they're there, but they're not, you know. We live in a world of a big fish, little pond, you know, or a little fish, big pond. And I was a little fish in a big pond. And it didn't matter who I spoke to, what happened, you know, it was deemed as, you know, disgusting. And, you know, you go through life of all these different things. It's much, much easier now, thankfully, for my generation and the ones, you know, going back now, like younger than me, it's going to be a lot easier for them. But as I, you know, grew up and I realised, I felt like I had no one really to talk to. I couldn't speak to my mum and I couldn't speak to my dad. To be honest, I never really told them anyway. It just kind of all fell into place. I couldn't tell them.
We never asked.
There was not a time where I thought, you know what, I'm going to sit down and speak to my parents, because I couldn't even speak to them about asking them for dinner, let alone, you know, telling them that I was coming out and I was going to be gay. You know, I felt like I could never do that, because they were never really there anyway.
You didn't trust them.
Yeah. I think you're very right there. It was a lack of trust. It was a lack of security.
Mm.
You know, I knew I was always safe with my parents, but I never really trusted them a full amount. You know, I would, if anything, if I was worried more about anything, then I would have gone to my sister. I would never have really gone to my parents, because as far as I was concerned, my sister was, you know, she was always going to be there, and she still will always be there to protect me.
It's like in that moment, you want nothing but utter presence. You don't want questions. You don't want anyone to try to fix you. Yeah. You just want utter presence and understanding and love. And it reminds me in a way of like when my nan and granddad were alive on my mother's side, going to see them, right? So going to see them wasn't an activity that we did out of love. So me and my ex-wife and my son, we would go to see them because we had to see them, because society says if you have a grandparent and they're old and you have a grandchild, that you need to take your grandchild to see your grandparents, because if you don't, then you're a bad kind of grandchild, right? So we would do that. Right. So every week I would go and see my nan and granddad and take Jude, and they would give him a pound and they would tell me the same old stories, and then I would leave. And for me, that moment was a hindrance. And it feels like for me, spending time with my parents is the same now. It's like it's a hindrance. I don't want to be there because they're not present for me. They don't accept me for who I am. I'm not able to talk about the things that I want to talk about, because not drinking with them, it's smoking. Like I cannot be around them while they are smoking. And the fact, and I have to accept, because of what I know about addictions, that them, their unwillingness to not stop smoking so they can spend more time with me and my and their granddaughter is nothing about, it's not connected to love. It's that they're addicts. And that is a shame, because I want to be around them and have those deep, meaningful conversations, but I'm not able to. So then it becomes this inauthentic relationship that you just kind of you abide by, and then you get to their death at some point, and then everybody's full of regret that they never had a full loving relationship. And it sounds like you had that kind of thing, like this plastic relationship that we have to have because we're daughter parent.
Yeah.
But now you're able to have a real proper relationship, what a child needs from their parent.
Yeah.
Moved on.
You know, I think you're definitely right there. You know, this is an example. I could turn up at work and I'd be distraught, because obviously I lived at home until August 2017, and I would hear them scream and shout at each other. You know, they would fight, they'd argue, Layla would be upset. I'd be wanting to go out and just get out of the way and do my own thing so that I wasn't involved with it. But then you'd sit and one would be sleeping on the sofa, one would be in bed. And it that's heartbreaking as a child. You know, you never want to see your parents go through that. And you know that as yourself, as you grow up in a relationship, one person sleeping on the sofa, you know how emotional that feels within yourself.
Mm.
But seeing that as a child from your parents and, you know, I went through school and everybody's parents seemed to be breaking up. It was like, whoa, one's going one way and one's going the other way. And then when you came home and one would be sleeping on the sofa and one would be in bed, that's worrying, you know.
Always scared.
And it's even when you get to a certain age, you know, I would walk into work and I'd express my feelings to my boss, you know, I'd be gutted and I'd be heartbroken. And then she asked me my boss is very good. She is like another parent to me as such, really. And she turned around to me one day and she said, well, how would you feel if you just moved out of the situation? I said, I can't do that. They're my parents. And she said exactly what you said. Well, are they though? Because the parents that you want are not them. You want parents that are loving and somebody that's, when you walk in the door and you're crying, is gonna listen and understand. Not somebody that's going to listen but then disagree with what you have to say and argue about it and make you feel worse. You know, and times where we've sat down and tried to express how we feel sometimes to mum and dad, it was, we would end up having arguments about something that's really hurt me. You know, I could walk in and tell them that the sky was blue and I'd be told, no, it's not, it's grey. That's the easiest way to probably explain it, you know, and I'd be upset by that because I'm like, well, no, because this is my emotion. This is how I feel about it. And you're telling me that that's wrong.
Mm.
But you can't tell me that's wrong because that's how I'm feeling and that's me. Yeah. You know, they're my emotions. No one can tell me how to feel my emotions. Whereas, you know, and then that was it in 2017. And I realised, well, am I just doing this stereotype thing where just because they're my parents, I have to live with them and I have to see them and I have to do things with them? Well, actually, no, I'm going to step away from that now and I'm going to do what's right by me and what's going to benefit me in my life. Because I knew if I stayed around it and they didn't do anything about it, then maybe I'd have been in a different place to where I am now. Maybe I might have turned to drink. Maybe I'd have started smoking again because the stress would have all got a bit too much and it works for them drinking. So why shouldn't I go and have a pint? You know, when I get stressed, why don't I go sink 10 pints because my parents can't be asked to listen to me? And frantically, they don't give a shit because they're too worried about having their own drink and blaming everything on everybody else but themselves.
Wow.
So at that point, I thought, you know what, I'm going to do what's right by me because I don't want to be an adopter. I don't want to be, you know, and this isn't being disrespectful to anyone that does have mental health issues. You know, everybody suffers differently, but I didn't want to be that type of person. I don't want to go to the doctor and have to explain how I felt and because of my parents. You know, I wanted to be my own person and grow to be loving towards my nieces and my children. And I didn't want, you know, even now I have my nieces and we don't drink around them because we don't want them to see that. You know, I'm this fun auntie where if we go to the pub and your parents are drinking, I'm on the bouncy castle. I'm having fun. I'm going to relive my childhood, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to be that person sinking 10 pints in the corner like my, you know, like what would have happened when I was a kid.
Yeah, you raise your kid in a pub and as they get older, that's where they're going to go towards. And it's, you know, it's very difficult because, I mean, you're quite fortunate in a way. Most people, you know, like me, I grew up hating my mum and dad smoking and drinking, but I just flew into both of them when I was older. I mean, it's the blueprints that we adopt from our parents are so, so deeply scarred within us that I'll say, like, I don't want to be my dad when I'm older, and you become your dad, and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, all you can do is just retain your awareness, like it seems that you have there, Georgie, and keep learning and thinking and being more mindful about the actions you're taking. So we've been here for an hour and 10 minutes. Ian, I can see you're watching. I'm going to ask you if you want a question in a minute. But before I do that, Is Georgie, is there anything you want to say to your mum? Stella, is there anything you want to say to Georgie?
I'm proud of her and I love her.
I'm proud of her for helping me with the podcast. I'm glad she come on, Lee, because there isn't a podcast, is there, telling me about the kids?
You know why that is? Because there's not enough parents who are brave enough to sit there whilst their children talk about these really hurtful truths, you know.
It must be hard to listen to.
I was that child. Don't forget too. Also, and you're right, Lee. The generations do change. So I changed in a way where I could have been worse than what I was in Suffolk if we'd have stayed living in Yorkshire. Absolutely, but. My blueprint got a little bit sort of watered down, and then now it's gone to Georgie. It's lovely to see Layla and Layla and Georgie's, and it's watered down again. Whereas I used to think that it was just pure thick blueprint, and that was it, end of. And it's not. No. It can be made different, and it can be eradicated. Like what Georgie said there, I love that. When now I can be that stupid 54-year-old getting on the Bounty Castle too.
Yeah.
And if I do bust my neck or my hand or my feet or whatever, it's not going to be, oh, it was my shoes. Oh, I got it stuck in my dress.
No, you were an idiot and you fell over. No,
I just fell over. Yeah. Because no drink were involved. You know, everyone has to blame something when they've been drinking on why they've hurt themselves. And it won't be the drink that gets the blame. It'll be the shoe or they got it caught on something.
Different.
So yeah, I want to be like that, and I love that. You know, like now when Sky comes around and she'll say to me, "Oh, Nanny, can we watch that dirty program?" And I'm like, "Dirty program? What program's that, Sky?" She went, "You know, the people who clean their houses, Nanny." Oh yes, of course. Come on, then. I was like, "Oh, we haven't been drinking, Lee." That would have gone, you know.
What dirty program is that?
And that's the nicest thing about it, you know, because when Skye does come now and, you know, and we stay with her,
it's so cute.
She will come upstairs and she, "Nanny, I want to watch that dirty program." And she will lay here for hours.
Yeah.
And they will just watch this, "How clean is your house?" It's called
"How clean is your house?"
But it's the dirty program. But they're sitting here and they're laughing and giggling. Now, had Mum have been drunk, she won't remember then.
No.
You know, there was times I can tell her now that Skye came in and she was probably two, three years old. And they've, you know, played games with Sylvanians in the garden and Mum probably won't even remember. Mm. We've got pictures of them messing around, you know, and those are precious things. And I think that's really important now as I grow up, and that I'm more thankful for than ever, is now that when I have my own children, I can watch my parents and I can take photos of my parents playing with my children, knowing that they will remember those memories and my children will have good memories of my parents, not bad ones like I did.
Yeah.
You know,
it'll be all in the eyes.
And it will be my children will grow up to look at their nanny and granddad and go, "I'm proud of them. And they made a good parent out of, you know, what they did for me, really." Yeah.
The other thing to be mindful of is, like, Jude, my boy who's 18, you know, whenever I ask him about, like, "How do you feel I raised you when I was younger, when I was drinking?" Jude will always say, "Oh, you were the best dad, you played with me," or et cetera, et cetera. So when you are in a garden playing Sylvanian families, you are playing Sylvanian families. So for the kids' point of view, they're like, "Oh, yeah, my mum is, like, there for me." However, as I keep saying to my son, you have absolutely no idea what it would have felt like if you would have had the full force of parental presence in those moments. I could have done so much more with you. I would have done so much more with you. And you have this view of, like, life was great, but life was nowhere near as great as it could be.
Yeah.
I'm going to mute you two a minute, and I'm going to just bring Ian in. Ian and Doug have been watching Doug's. I've had to go to work by the looks of it. I'm just going to ask Ian if he's got a question. So I'm just going to mute you, ladies. I'm just going to unmute Ian. How's life, Ian?
How are you doing? Right.
Good. Do you have any questions for Stella or Georgie or anything come up for you as we've been talking about this?
No, it's quite interesting actually when you mentioned about the idea that when you speak to your friends about not being someone who drinks alcohol anymore, how they will still try and get you to drink rather than say you were to go over with a heroin addiction problem, they wouldn't go, oh, go on, have a little bit of heroin, have some crack, have a smoke. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what I'm finding. That's probably what I'm going to be more concerned about at the moment.
He's talking to your friends about
it. Yeah, bringing that into it, you know.
Well, you're in the right place over at Strive. You know, we can help you almost like create scripts, practice with people about how to do it. And it's, I think the more that you don't drink alcohol, Ian, the more that you will gain confidence and the courage to actually be yourself. Because all that's probably happening right now is you're trying to fit into a stereotype of what you perceive your friends need you to be in order for you to remain part of that tribe, right?
Yeah, there is some of that. Yeah, definitely.
You'll be okay. Okay, right. Hang on a minute. I'm going to mute you again, Ian. I'm going to unmute Stella and Georgie. Okay, Stella and Georgie, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure. It's not easy to have these conversations. I'm really glad you've done it. I'm going to try to get my boy on here at some point to do that as well. So basically, thank you. Thanks, Stella, for everything you do on Strive. Stella is a Strive ambassador. She's like a rock for us. So thank you for that. And Georgie, it sounds like you're in a really good place, that you have maturity beyond your years. And thank you very much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Greatly. Thank you.
Thank you. I will see you all in Strive. Enjoy your flight to New Zealand, Stella.
Yes. I'll see you tonight at 8.
Yes. See you tonight at 8. Take care, Ian. Goodbye, Georgie. Bye now.
See you later. Bye, everyone. Bye.
If the truth about alcohol philosophy jives with you and you want to become someone that doesn't drink alcohol, then there are several options available to you, okay? According to the research carried out by Janice and James Prochaska, there are 6 stages of change when it comes to defeating an addiction. And let me assure you, that is your problem. It is an addiction, right? Now, these 6 stages of change are as follows. 1, pre-contemplation. 2, contemplation. 3, preparation. 4, action. 5, maintenance. And 6, termination. And translated into truth about alcohol philosophy, these categories become this, right? 1, the death effect. 2, visualization. 3, incubation. 4, ready, steady, go. 5, transformation. And 6, service. And that just makes a nice little acronym, STRIVE. Ha! That's why I did that, right? So these 6 stages of the truth about alcohol are not fixed in stone, right? They're fluid. And you'll move between these stages depending on a variety of different factors. But understanding where you are on this spectrum is really critical, okay? Now, 1, the first category you're going to be in, which the Prochaska's called pre-contemplation and I'm calling the death effect, that's when you really are struck by the zombification of societal conditioning. You have no idea that alcohol is a problem, that alcoholism exists. You just think that alcohol is fucking brilliant and that is the end of, right? And that will not be affecting you right now because you're here listening to this. But that is that first level, that first category, the death effect. At the second level, contemplation, as the Prochaska's call it, or for me, visualization, this is where you start to think and question the role that alcohol has in your life, right? And as you're thinking about this and you're pondering and you're kind of visualizing kind of like, you know, how alcohol is having a negative effect in your life and what it could possibly be like if it's not in your life anymore, you may have joined the Alcohol Addiction Podcast and listened to this. You may have headed over to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and joined our email list. You might be reading our blog post. You might have picked up a few books and started reading on those. At the third stage is called preparation, right? Or what we call incubation. And this is where you might go a little bit further. And you're now starting not only to kind of listen to podcasts and read some books, but you're actually preparing to change, right? The idea that you could potentially be someone that doesn't drink alcohol is starting to incubate. And you could, at this stage, have joined a community forum like Strive. Or you might have joined Nis Naked Minds forum or Hip Sobriety's Facebook group or something. But you're starting to prepare for change. The fourth category is action, or what we call ready, steady, go. And this is where you really are now starting to take some real solid action. And if you're ready to take action, then you should take the Truth About Alcohol Taster. The Truth About Alcohol Taster is a 27-day program. You can join the program whenever you like. You just go to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk and you can find the links there to join up. Or you can email me at thetruthaboutalcohol@gmail.com and I'll sort you out. You join basically a group and you can just work on being someone who doesn't drink alcohol for 27 days to give it a little bit of a feel. We'll introduce you to the Truth About Alcohol philosophy, our three modules of truth, awareness, and freedom. We'll learn to help you see the truth about alcohol, why you drink, why it's so difficult to stop, raise awareness of that truth internally so you can start to change some of those neurological pathways, those thought process and belief systems around alcohol, and then freedom. How do you assert yourself back into a society of people that don't drink alcohol? You do the homework on Strive, you get an assignment every day from myself, and one of the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors will lead you along the way. So that's kind of the action stage. The fifth stage is called maintenance, or what we call transformation. This is where the work really takes off, right? Now, it's really important to understand that moving between the incubation phase and the ready, steady, go phase, you know, so whilst you're kind of like preparing to take action, that could take anywhere up to 6 months. And once you've started to take action, the actual maintenance phase, which is what we call transformation, the stage where you are really working on becoming someone that doesn't drink alcohol permanently, that phase can take up to 5 years, right? It can take that long. It certainly takes six months plus for you to really nail it or give yourself a good shot at this. And for that reason, we've created the intensive. The Truth About Alcohol Intensive, it's a year, an annual subscription where we get really deep into the truth about alcohol, raising awareness of that truth and working out how to be free of it. And we're up to like 70 plus coaching videos. You work with all the Truth About Alcohol ambassadors and myself. It's a great, great process, okay? One of the big mistakes people make is they'll take the taster, so they start to take action, and then once they finish the taster, they don't continue into the maintenance phase, and that can lead them fall back into some of those earlier categories. So it's really important to do the intensive and get through that transformation phase. And then finally, sixth, termination, as the Prochaskas call it, or I like to call it service. This is where it doesn't matter what happens now, you're never going to drink alcohol. It doesn't matter, you're never triggered, nothing ever happens, you're just fucking done with it, right? And that's where I am right now. And this is where we at the Truth About Alcohol can offer you some roles to, you know, give back to the community, give back to the world, and help me create this movement of a million people that don't drink alcohol. And that is to extend yourself into the roles of either a Strive ambassador, where you lead in the Strive movement and really are a rock helping new people come to Strive, or you can become a Truth About Alcohol ambassador, where we pay you to take control of the taster groups and the intensive groups and really work with people who are ready to take the action phase. So if you are ready right now, okay, to start to think about moving up into the next stage, so, you know, you're in contemplation phase now and you're thinking about going to preparation, join Strive, right? It's £5 a month. It'll be the best £5 you've ever spent. If you're ready to take action, if you're ready to do something about this, then join the taster. Okay, that's £99, right? Join the taster. And then if you are just ready to just fucking be someone that doesn't drink alcohol and that is like something you want to do permanently, then join the intensive. That is £1,000. We've got payment plans available. Do not let money be the reason why you do not take this, because we can always sort something out or find you some help, all right? So head over to thetruthaboutalcohol.co.uk to join those experiences, or give me an email at truthaboutalcohol@gmail.com. Remember this, folks, okay? You drink alone, but you do not have to stop drinking alone. That's why we're here for you. So reach out and help. Take care of yourself.